You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
Yeah, what you sort of want to lean towards is a bit of a sociopath that's only interested in it to win and doesn't care about the monetary impact. So you do want to lean to that person every now and then that's just in it to win. But I mean, you want that guy that's that person that's just, you know, they've got a deep inside passion for this, like your Eric Sprott, you know, that somebody else would have just taken that money, you know, and bought a small island or a big island. But he redeployed in the sector because that's what he loves.
You are listening to MSE. I'm Bill Powers. Thanks for tuning in. In today's episode, you're going to get an update, our quarterly update from Joe Mazumdar, analyst with explorationinsights.com. There's free resources there you can go check out, especially if you're newer to the sector. And Joe also offers a paid subscription looking at more of the earlier stage companies and projects in the junior resource sector. So Joe, welcome back onto the program. You just got back from Toronto, PDAC. You're back in British Columbia. Could you break down for us what you observed at PDAC in Toronto last week or the week before?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Thanks for the invite, our quarterly get together. I would, you know, if we could break it down, some of it might be, you know, concerns about the electric vehicle thematic, because as you see, you know, the penetration in the States is nowhere near the penetration in other countries like in China and Europe. There's changing battery technology, which changing the demand for different metals and minerals, and infrastructure for these EVs, even though places like California and even Canada, I believe that they want us to all be driving EVs by 2035. You know, nobody's sure if there's actually, one, the infrastructure in place to accept these EVs if they actually purchased them, and whether people could actually afford them if without a subsidy. And then you get the segmentation of the market. I mean, there's a lot of problems that I don't think the government or these people that are mandating this stuff that understand, but they're still forcing people to do this, which, you know, might come back to bite them. So that's one thematic. Another one is the popularity of copper doesn't stop. And I'm a big copper bull in that sense. And I did a talk in Chile about the growth necessary in the copper market and where Chile is falling short. And then developing like 23% of the growth still has to come from Chile. But whether it can get permanent, whether it has access to water or power, you know, becomes a bit of a constraint on a lot of these Chilean projects under the current regime as well. A bit problematic, and you know, talking to the people that are in charge of the mining chamber of mines in Chile, they're talking about that there's no even point in talking to this present government, and then just wait 2 years until there's a next election, rather than, you know, giving them the time of day. Another one, like in terms of copper, we saw that the U.S. government, we saw that. Resolution got that land swap accepted by a court, which is a positive in terms of getting things done in the States for now. The other thematic might be that the younger people, let's say less than 45, you know, given my age, are so not so keen on the barbarous relic, which is gold. And interestingly, you know, I just looked it up, you know, John Maynard Keynes, when he said that about gold being a barbarous relic, was about 100 years ago. So, you know, we're still talking about the barbarous relic, so it can't have been that, I mean, still here. So, but the Chinese are still keen. So, you know, there's been about, was it about 10 million ounces that they've added to their reserves since late 2022. But interestingly, in terms of their total reserves, they're still sitting at about 4.3%. Whereas the States and Germany, they're sitting at 70%. So I don't even want to imagine what the gold price would be if the Chinese's ultimate goal was to get to that level, you know. So that's another thing. And then the financing difficulties continue for juniors, especially the precious metal guys. And as we were talking off air, the floor was not as popular, even though the number of delegates or attendees that the PDAC says is more than last year and getting to pre-COVID levels. There's not much retail moving around those those hallways, the aisles. More of the meetings were happening outside, and that's where I think a lot of the CEOs and small companies were going to, a lot of these meetings with majors, with governments, to look for funding. So if you went to the booths, you wouldn't always see the CEO there anymore. He'd probably be off, or she would be off in a meeting sometime. But interestingly and positively, we've been seeing a little bit more M&A in the junior sector for gold. I mean, the critical minerals have been good, but we saw Osino, get bid by Dundee Precious Metals at a decent premium. And then they got overbid by a Chinese company. And, so that was good. We haven't seen a lot of multiple bid. And then the last bid was all cash. So that's positive. A lot of different themes at PDAC to get through. Very, very interesting conference always to attend, to see, to take a little bit of the pulse of the industry.
Just to hit on one of the points you made about the companies seeking out funds from the government and from the majors, did a lot of the Explorco CEOs that you engaged with, were they not even seeking it from retail at this point or high net worth individuals because the money's not there?
Well, I see a lot of people spending more money, not less, on IR to try and go to more of these different conferences that go to different investment hubs, whether it's Europe, whether it's in the States, or some of them, looking even to all the way to Australia. They'll go anywhere they can to find out if what they have is more attractive to a different investment hub. And so they'll spend the money there. I don't know about, but I've seen some companies spend a heck of a lot more on, let's call them newsletters, whatever, to pay them to talk about companies as well. So there's been more of that, which sounds counterintuitive, but, when times get desperate, people get even more desperate, I guess. But yeah, the financing risk is still real, and there's probably a bit of, people coming back into the market. So we've seen some positive moves. I've seen them in the portfolio the last few weeks. But, the other concern would be that as soon as these prices go up, then they're going to raise money for the next field season. And so what will that price be? Will they be issuing warrants again? That sort of thing. So that's something we got to watch.
You were recently in Australia. Can you compare for us, North American investors like myself, the sentiment between the ASX miners and the TSX miners?
Now, I guess what we got to understand is the ASX retail versus TSX retail. I mean, ASX retail, most of those companies that they invest in would more likely take the company from soup to nuts in terms of trying to develop it. That's sort of their mindset. So the filtering is already in the management that they wouldn't take a project and re-drill a bunch of holes because that might not add a lot of value to what they're ultimately trying to do. They don't have a lot of disinterested shareholders. There's not a lot of flow through. There is no flow through. So, and there's no four-month holes. So you don't have a lot of people investing in companies for a tax break. You don't have people that are handcuffed, after a private placement, there is a hold on that. You could trade it right away. So the only reason to do the private placement rather than not do it is for a fund to basically lock in a price and lock in, so they're not buying in the market and competing against themselves. So for me, that's a much cleaner structure. Everybody's in it for the company, for the management. It's a better reflection of the company than, people in Canada potentially getting, issuing shares at a premium to disinterested shareholders that are looking for a tax break. And then if you looked at, in terms of funding, the TSX and the venture has come down so much and the ASX has come up somewhat that now the ASX and the TSX in terms of global funding is about the same. So even though we say, the ASX has done so much better, it has done better, but that's because the TSX has taken a big step backwards. And so you can see examples where companies, like let's say Capstone Minerals is an intermediate copper producer. Their development projects are in Chile, Manto Verde, and Santo Domingo. They raised $431 million. last year in the markets, and that's a lot of money for copper development storage. Obviously, people want exposure to copper, but in the interim, they also dual listed on the ASX to get access to these superannuation funds that want access to copper, might not see it in an ASX listed company, so they can expose themselves there and then find funds that could help them fund their development projects going forward. And then on the counterpart, you could take something like Southern Cross Gold, which I visited when I was in Australia in Victoria, you know, high grade Fosterville-like project that most of the Fosterville money that funded that project was actually from Canada, you know, like Eric Sprott and other people that funded that project. New Market was a TSX listed company. New Market was bought by Kirkland, but New Market bought Crocodile Gold, which was also TSX listed, then Kirkland, and then Agnico's, all Canadian, Canadian, Canadian. And so the Canadian market is more attuned to the value of Fosterville than the people who actually live in Australia, because probably less of them made money off of it. So what you want to do if you're raising money is, when you're selling the story, is selling it to those people that made money off a similar story. And definitely for Southern Cross, that would be more so in Canada than on the ASX. So that's why they're looking to dual list. So some of this is nuanced in terms of, you know, looking for your audience. You have to be very specific, it seems there.
You know, Eric Sprott has funded a lot of the juniors in the Canadian markets over the years, in the last 8 years. And so do you see another Eric
Sprott? And that was funded. A lot of that was funded by his gains.
Right. Like $1 billion, right?
He made So if there's a really good talk that Dave Lotan did during the Red Cloud conference, and I would tell your listeners to go to check that out. It's very good. And in that, he talks about that money being redeployed. But somebody else might not have redeployed that money. You know, they might have just kept it, you know, but he redeployed it. And so that helped fund a lot of other stuff going forward. And so when I did that talk at the Victoria Mining Conference, I talked about the value of Fosterville, how it totally changed that mine, which was a marginal, refractory, low-grade underground mine that only, you know, recovered 80%. And then you could see the margins increase, the cash flow go through the roof, and then the ultimate valuations, you know, the combination of Crocodile Gold and New Market was like $190 million Canadian. The acquisition of New Market was like $1 billion. And then I'm not saying all of the valuation of Kirkland was rolled up in Fosterville, but definitely Fosterville was what Agnico wanted. And now we're talking about $10 billion. And so that's... So the best assets get taken over not once, twice, but sometimes three times. And the valuation just keeps going up and up and up and up. And so those sort of deposits are the ones that, you know, basically, you know, make the market. And they did make, you know, Eric Sprott obviously very wealthy, but he took that money and redeployed it.
So is there an Eric Sprott that will redeploy? So for example, Great Bear sold for a nice dollar, but I don't think we've seen a lot of the Great Bear wins redeployed into the juniors, have we?
Well, I mean, you could argue that John Robbins is redeploying some of that in these new companies he's taking out from the Discovery Group and building. I mean, it's sort of similar to Mark O'Day did with the win from Frontier from Long Canyon, and you know, made other companies. Some of them didn't turn out so well, admittedly. So there is some form of redeployment, I guess. But some of that might be just reputational redeployment, where, hey, I made you money in this, let's go on this journey together, and let's do it again. That sort of thing.
And in your experience, Joe, when you see a mining entrepreneur make a large sum of money, do you notice their motivation significantly decreased because, like, the next win isn't going to change their lifestyle at all at that point? Or do you see them work for ego's sake or glory?
What you sort of want to lean towards is a bit of a sociopath that's only interested in it to win and doesn't care about the monetary impact. So you do want to lean to that person every now and then that's just in it to win. But on the other side, I'm looking for the hungry person.
Okay, can I title this episode, Why You Should Invest with a Sociopath in Mining? Are you okay with that?
Yeah. Okay. but I mean, you want that guy that person that's just, you know, they've got a deep inside passion for this, like your Eric Sprott, you know, that somebody else would have just taken that money, you know, and bought a small island or a big island. But he redeployed in the sector because that's what he loves, you know. And unfortunately, that's what I'm pinned to, you know, because I love what I do. I love, you know, reading about technical reports. I love going on site visits. I like seeing new, you know, geological models, all that sort of stuff. So I'm pinned to this. This is what I like. And so people say, oh, do I invest a dollar in this mining resource sector or a dollar in Bitcoin? I'm not going to answer that question because I'm all on this side. I'm all on the mining side.
Joe, so I'm an American that came in as a retail investor, as you know. So when I started to attend these conferences in 2017, after a few years, my perspective, and correct me if you don't think I'm right here, but my perspective was for a lot of these junior pre-production companies, it's almost like the guys want to be a part of it so that four times a year they can come hang out with their high school buddies and have a good time. And they didn't seem to have that drive that you're talking about. I mean, is there anything to what I've observed as a total outsider, especially when I started?
Absolutely, because some of these guys, that's what they do. I mean, and some of them, like the Canadian market, has let them do that, especially if their assets in Canada. You know, the Quebec environment where, you know, you're always going to be funded by these companies because you've got an office in Quebec. You know, so you always know you got money. The problem is coming up with an idea. So when people are having troubles coming up with ideas, but they're already getting funded, then, you know, that's not something you want to own. So you want these people with great ideas. And they're always coming up with new ideas. And sometimes, like, I've looked at some people and thought, you know, well, these are great people, but Jesus, I went to their asset and it sucked. And I went, well, they're getting a premium and the underlying sucks. But what I didn't realize is that these people eventually will filter and find something worth your money. And that, for me, would be the best example for me would be Rupert. You know, I went there, saw the asset that they were looking to deploy capital to and to build, Patavara, I think it was. And I thought, well, no, this is not going to work. And then I looked at the valuation and I said, well, Jesus, I can get this for that. But what I didn't realize was, you know, eventually this management team would find something, and they did, Ikkari. And they know how to manage capital. They know how to make, and it's done very well.
Can you break that down for us? They were in the news this week. Can you break down them wanting to buy B2 Gold 70% of Orion Resources?
Yeah, so Ikkari, the issue with Ikkari is that, I mean, it's a great deposit, continuous, and this is exactly what companies want. They want continuous mineralization. So people get caught up in the grade, and this grade is good, but the grade is continuous. It's not sporadic. So you want to watch this thing called a coefficient of variation when you look at a resource. The high numbers would be your Rubicons, your Pure Gold, Madsen's, and even Brucejack. But Brucejack, eventually they proved that they can make money off of it. But that wasn't the case for Pure Gold, definitely not the case for the F2 zone of Rubicon. So when you're in that zone of high CV, you want to be very wary of what that grade is. So then you take that and you go Rupert, much smaller CV, but you still get the grade and it's open pittable. Then you go, well, this is exactly what anybody would want in a country like Finland that has all the infrastructure you could ask for. So it's definitely like a tier one asset in terms of that, you know, being able to be developed. The problem is that the southern boundary of it comes on to a joint venture area between B2 Gold and Orion Resources, which I own. And so Orion has a big land package in Finland. They have joint ventures with B2 Gold, with Kinross, and they also have other ground that they're looking for critical minerals. But most of their money is being spent by B2 Gold on their joint venture on some of their own ground at Bristi, Launi. So The thing is that the PEA that ICRI put out, that Rupert put out on ICRI, is suboptimal because they could be a layback onto the Orion B2Gold joint venture that would defer the underground and give you more open pit amenable ounces. So more ounces at cheaper cost. And that has an impact, NPV impact, which is not insignificant. So that impact is basically what, how do you value that impact? The impact of that and how you value it is basically what's wrapped up in Orion's right of first refusal, because Rupert has just made a bid on their, on B2Gold's 70% of the joint venture, which values it at about 103 million Canadian, the 70%. That would value Orion's 30% at 40 million. And what Orion is arguing is it's not worth 40 million. So now they have 60 days to convince other people that it's worth a lot more than that, and they help us get that 70%. So they would look for a partner that would pay for them for the first right of refusal. You know, I don't know, 10 million, 15 million, I don't know how much. That would go into their treasury. And then this party would buy it for B2Gold's purchase price, which was 103 million. I'm sorry, Rupert's bid. Because now that price is locked. It's not going to change. So it's locked at 103 million. Even though it was in shares, it's locked at 103 million. So that's what they have 60 days to do. And so in a more buoyant gold price environment, a great jurisdiction, you know, and I don't think anybody wants to build that project without knowing they have the southern ground. So somebody who consolidates that, you know, sorry, somebody who builds that mine needs that ground consolidated. And that's the path forward. And we've got 60 days to find out which way it goes.
And this is where management matters, right? Because Orion has a lot of cards that they have here, and you got to negotiate and play
you
it right.
You couldn't get anybody better than David Lotan as the chairman of Orion to make sure we don't get screwed.
And you say we because you're a shareholder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The grander we.
you and your subscribers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, when I had another situation and it would be complicated like this, and, you know, there'd be a CEO that was really not up to it, then I'd be worried. This I'm not worried about.
Joe, thanks for your insights on that one. Let's move on to nickel, if you could talk about that. BHP has said that they see the nickel industry facing a difficult multi-year run, and our base case is that the market may rebalance by late 2020s. So is there a reason to be bullish on nickel in the near term, according to this forecast?
Well, if you just take what BHP says and just ignore it, we could have done that last time when they were all bullish on nickel. So, they've gone from being really bullish about 18 months ago to 2 years now to being very negative on nickel. And they're, you know, all the people they pay to forecast that did not predict the growth in Indonesian production. So I did this talk, and I had a rant about this in the letter called Why the Nickel Market Sucks, just to basically say, what's the basis of the 45% drop of the nickel price? And most of that was Indonesian oversupply and Chinese destocking as they're sort of transitioning a bit from your nickel-intensive batteries in the EVs to what they call lithium iron phosphate batteries, which are your LFPs, which you don't need nickel. And so, that's part of it. It's probably the biggest part. But if you take everybody else outside of Indonesia, there's not a lot of growth. So what we're seeing now on a positive side is we're seeing a lot of mines being shut down. So when I was in Australia, the Avebury mine in Tasmania was recently shut down, and that just opened up. So that one's sort of a very marginal mine that'll open and close, depending on where the nickel price is. And the hope for nickel is that Indonesia could not sign a free trade agreement with the States. So now that nickel that comes into that EV battery cannot get the IRA, Inflation Reduction subsidy. So they can't get that. And if you can't get the subsidy, I mean, there's not very many people that are going to be attracted to an EV car that doesn't have the subsidy. So that's a problem. That's problematic for Indonesia. So, and then other problem is that some banks have pointed out, like Macquarie, is that it's harder to permit in Indonesia now. And so that might slow their growth. So if we have a combination of continued cutting of production, which we've seen globally, because at current prices, I think it's 30 to 40% of production is underwater. If you drop that nickel price another buck, it's like 60 or 70% of production's underwater. So the market really doesn't make any sense with respect to the price, what Indonesia's supplying, and the demand scenario right now. So we need a lot of those cuts, which we're getting. And I saw those same cuts in the copper market in the 2000s when I worked for Phelps Dodge. And that worked, and we had about a two-year turnaround. You know, I'm not saying that that's going to be translated into a two-year turnaround, but these are positive signs for the seeds of the return of the nickel market. If we get that segmentation, the problem is that there's not a lot of non-Indonesian copper out there that could actually is incentivized to develop, rather even produce in this environment. So unless the Western markets try to make up that difference, it's hard to believe that a lot of these projects that are non-Indonesian are going to come on, unless there's a way of incentivizing these people to develop them. And so that's the sort of, you know, where we are right now with the nickel market. There's more than enough nickel being produced for the current demand by Indonesia. But the problem is, if that's going into car batteries that are trying to be sold in the States, they might not get sold in the States.
Interesting take. So would you be bullish on a junior nickel explorer or developer, or would you stay away for a couple of years? What's your take on that in light of that macro perspective?
I've got one nickel one that I haven't sold, and I'll keep it, but I'm not like diving in big time into the nickel market, because there's a lot of this government stuff that I have to be to know that which way they're going to go. And for me to bet on any government is just like, that's sort of like, no, I don't want to do that. So I'm not going 100% saying, oh, hey, all these development places in Canada are going to get built. That's hard, because these are multi-billion-dollar projects, not a lot of infrastructure. And who's going to give you that price that incentivizes somebody to lend you money? You know, I don't see that price out there right now. And I don't know how it's going to work out.
Artificial intelligence is a big point of topic for investors right now. As you know, it's a hot commodity, so to speak. What do you see the role of artificial intelligence in junior mining and mining in general in the future, moving forward?
So what I don't want to see is what I have seen. I've seen this company that's a private company, Silicon Valley backed. I think Bill Gates and everybody else that have more money than God, that are funding this company called Cobalt Metals. And Cobalt Metals is doing a lot of good work with artificial intelligence, working on big databases. They've been going for a while and being funded for a while, but they haven't had anything to show. So they went out, spent $130 million and bought a copper asset in Zambia. Sediment-hosted copper, similar to your Kamoa-Kakula, and you know, in the Central African Copper Belt. And they also have to commit another $35 million, I believe, to exploration expenditures. So this was not, as they have said, or the media is reporting, that it was an AI discovery. It's not an AI discovery. This deposit was known. I know people that have drilled it before. So to try and say, oh, AI found it, to promote the idea of AI, I think that's wrong. You know, I think AI, it's a tool that's definitely that you can use. And I think it's got a place, but like any other tool, it's got to be managed. But saying that, you know, their methodology worked and discovered this thing, I don't think that's true.
What's your outlook for junior mining stocks for the rest of the year, generally speaking? Positive, undecided, or?
Better than last year, but I know with the caveat that a lot of these guys have to raise money. So coming into the season, a lot of them were not funded for the some optimistic plans that they have or just a basic plan. And so what I've done as well is I've tried to reduce my exposure to places that are more remote and cost more per meter to drill. So if you can't get a lot of money, I'd rather more money was spent on the ground rather than some companies which, you know, they could raise $3 million or $4 million, but that's maybe a 1,500 meter drill program that would not prove anything. And then next time they come to the market, they're raising at another 20 or 30% discount. So if they don't hit that hole. So for all your listeners, you know, grassroots exploration, if you're into that, that's a plan that requires funding for at least 3 to 5 years in some places, like at least with big companies. You need the right people that know what they're doing, but they need to be consistently funded. They don't need to be overly funded, just consistently so they can plan on what they're doing. The problem with a junior is to raise money, they need to drill that hole or they need to do that thing that gets the market, you know, buying their shares such that they can raise at that level. With a big company, they don't need that because they can prove geologically that it makes sense and continue to get funded. But trying to convince the retail market that geologically it makes sense, even though you don't have any results, is like almost a non-starter. So you need this funding. Companies like Inflection Resources that I visited in Australia, Macquarie Arc, Volcanics, New South Wales, you know, one of the biggest copper gold mines out there, Cadia, is hosted in that. And there's a lot of other smaller mines, but still significant, in where the Macquarie Arc outcrops. And these guys have taken all the ground to where the Macquarie Arc goes undercover. But that kind of program, I didn't buy it originally because that kind of program requires, you know, multi-year funding. And retail just would not fund that. So I did not buy into it, until they got this Anglo-American joint venture earning where they're funded multiple years. So if they find the right alteration, you know, on these multi-kilometer space holes that indicates they might be close, they'll still get funded. Whether if they went to the retail market, there's a way they would get funded.
You were a portfolio manager at Newmont, which not many people know, and I didn't know until recently. Or functionally like a portfolio manager, but not the traditional portfolio manager.
I wouldn't have called it that. There was a portfolio.
They allowed you to buy and sell junior mining stocks that Newmont owned, right?
Yes, I managed it.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't call myself a portfolio manager in the sense that you see people. I mean, it was basically $1 billion worth of equity, but the majority of it was in an oil company.
Joe, there's no exploration fund out there that I know of that's $1 billion right now.
But most of it, at that point, I think 70% of it at that point, which was about 2008 or 9 or something like that, maybe 7 before the global financial crisis. And this is actually an interesting story. So I started it before the global financial crisis, consolidated it, and the rationale is very different than, you know, your typical portfolio manager. My only interest was in holding companies that Newmont, that they had assets that potentially could be a Newmont asset. That's the only reason we held it. If it didn't, we weren't there to make money off of it in terms of the share position. So in terms of a liability, I consolidated all the different, and this was back in the days where you have to get paper share certificates where nobody knew where they were, and I had to phone up all these different brokerage accounts firms to find out where actually Newmont held its shares. I also found out that, you know, we failed to tell people we were insiders, so we had to pay a fine because we never told people we were insiders because we held more than 10% or something like that. So all this was fun, but it was a different way of looking at how you manage the portfolio because it's not the same
as somebody who wants to make money from that portfolio, as opposed to somebody who wants to find a deposit with that portfolio.
So like one of the takeaways, if I'm thinking this through for newer mining investors, if they're investing in a junior Explorco that Newmont or another big boy has a 20% interest in, you should pay attention to if Newmont or the other major producer is still interested in that stock. Because if you want to offload that position, you could cut the market cap by 65%.
Yeah, well, that what you have to realize, was it a passive investment in that we ended up with 19.9% because they couldn't pay us cash. So we ended up with their equity. And for me, as the manager of that equity position, I don't want it. So I would phone them up and say, hey, you know, you got a month, I'm going to sell it slowly after that, you know, because I don't want, you know, to put you off or anything like that, but I got to get rid of it. So you got a month to find me a buyer. And so that's how we would work it. We wouldn't like sell it one day, at least I wouldn't sell it one day without telling them.
Would you have taken a call from a retail investor that's interested in one of the companies that Newmont had a 20% interest in? They found their way to you because they realized you were the guy in charge of buying or selling, where you're going to hold or get rid of this position. And they asked you, are you still interested in XYZ Explorco that you own 20% of? Would you have given them a forthright answer? I'm saying, is due diligence even possible for a retail investor in this regard?
Well, I tell you, like, no retail investor would ever phone us about that. But we did get phone calls from smaller producers, so Eldorado Gold. When I joined Newmont, they were getting out of everything that was in Greece and Turkey. So we were divesting of that. And that was, okay, here's this company called, I think it was Frontier Pacific. It was a Perama Hill, nice open pit, heap leach grade deposit. But it was in Greece. So we didn't want it. So this company wanted it. We ended up with 19.9% of it. And then when the market was picking up, we got a call from a banker and they put this guy who was the CEO of Eldorado, I forget what his name was, we're talking to him, me and the VP of business development, saying, you know, and they're trying to convince us to sell them, to vote to sell them our stake. So that's, you know, what we would get. We wouldn't get, the other thing we would get is that, see, I consolidated all those different share positions in one brokerage firm, right? Or bank. And so I would trade it just with them. And then when I started seeing that they were buying the positions I was selling directly and not even going to the market, then I realized that something was changing in the market sentiment. Like, I sold a bunch right before the global financial crisis, not knowing anything to do about the global financial crisis, but that...
Joe, you're a newsletter writer. You should have claimed that as one of your marks of success right there.
Yeah,
I sold before the crash.
It was a total buck. Okay. It was total... My focus was on trying to clean it up, because we held a lot of stuff that we didn't want. And so I sold a lot of it before the world financial crisis. And then everything tanked. And then, you know, I look like a bit of a hero, but it was just doing what I set out to do. I mean, it wasn't like any brilliant move on my part. No one's going to write a book about it.
It sells newsletter writers, though. I'm trying to help you here on the marketing side, Joe.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Okay. But your picks,
yeah, anyway,
your picks, when you do offer them, you do a geological deep dive because you're dealing with earlier stage projects.
Even big companies, I mean, like, look at, a lot of these guys fail because of geological resource, and that could be at any level. Why look at? I mean, we try to keep it constrained between the technical, unbiased, and independent view, and that's what makes the letter. So if people are interested in that, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
And could you leave us with one recent pick, if you're willing to share? I know you periodically share. Anything you'd like to talk about?
Well, I mean, I would say, like, because of my interest in the copper market and the copper development play that I still have as a top pick, I would say Arizona Sonora.
you know, for all the reasons that I like the copper market, it's producing cathode potentially, not concentrate. So it's got exposure to the U.S. market. All good there. And they've done recent presentations in that, and I think they've done very well. But the share price is down, so it's still a decent entry point to get into it.
Excellent. Well, Joe's website is explorationinsights.com. As I mentioned at the outset, there's free articles there. And if you're interested in more of Joe's specific insights on the sector and his picks, you can also look into his subscription service there. Joe, I always appreciate catching up with you, and I'll reach back out to you in about 3 months to come back on the show.
Great. Thanks very much, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.